and 2. All right, so tonight is December 14th?
17th.
17th. I just put it on. Tonight is December 17th. This is our sixth class. I guess the 1300s. You know, it's like the sixth shiur. I haven't gotten there yet. We've just gotten just to the sixth. I guess the preparations for the 1300s. Last week we were talking about the Marami Rotenberg, and we're going to continue with his life. Again, we mentioned he was a German rabbi, not just a German rabbi. He was really the leader of his time of all of German Jewry for sure, and probably even world Jewry. You may see something that that would say something from a Spanish, from the somebody in Spain. He was last. They call him like the last of the Tosafot, or the Bali Tosafos. Even though his students, the Rosh, was he wrote the Tosafos HaRosh. But this is we're coming to the era, the end of the era of the Tosafos. The Rishonim era. This is. The Rishonim era really started with Rabbeinu Gershom and Rashi in the beginning of the end of the 11th century, the 1100s, and now this is going to be at the end of the 1200s. So there's about 200 years of Tosfos. Rishonim, I think we still are going to give them another 200-300 years for Rishonim until we get to Achronim. He's also known as the Marami Rotenberg. This is where he was. This is Worms, and I don't know if does it have it here, but I think Rotenberg was down here. Marami Rotenberg. Okay, he was in Worms, 1215 to 1220. I mentioned last time, just briefly, his Rebbe was the Arzarua, also the Rebbe Chila Paris, which we're going to discuss tonight. Because this is where he's going to be by his Rebbe, Rebbe Chila Paris, when the debates happen. Actually, we spoke about this list with the disputations, that's where we ended last week. Just a little bit, we'll discuss that. This is, again, another map of Germany. Not why I wanted this one more than the other, maybe because of Lombardy. This may come in, they come in to play today. Okay. Oh, Brandenburg. No. Okay. Anyway, his students, he had three students. One is the Agais Maimonides. I wrote a commentary on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, the Rush, who we may get to talk about this week, and Mordechai Ben Hillel Verona, we hope to also talk about. These two are going to, you know, talk about also the Tashbetz as well. Halachic Sefer. He wrote a lot of his tshuvas. Okay, Maram is a Tosfos. Tractate Yuma, that mainly came from the Maram. This is all a review from last week. These are the Tosfosim that are in Maseches Yuma, many of them authored or put together by the Maram. Okay, I think we did mention it last week that this in 1240, this is converted Jew by the name of Nicholas Donen, who had it out for Rabbi Chil of Paris and all the Jews, and he made he went to the church and he told them that we should have a debate and we should try to convince the Jews how right Christianity is. And he had learned Gemara and he was familiar with it, and he came up with 35 charges based on what was said in the Gemara. And I guess it took him this long till the 1200s for them to realize that what the Talmud was. They always thought that, you know, the Jews had an interpretation of the Bible and the Christians did, and that was it. You know, and the Jews is stubbornly holding on to their interpretations as opposed to the Christian interpretations. And all of a sudden, like we mentioned last week, they opened their eyes and they said, wait a minute, they have a whole Talmud. That's what their Talmud is. And they things that are in the Talmud that were definitely taken out of context very strange things, very far out things, and things against Christianity that now the Jews had to explain. And that was what was being done in Paris. When this happened, the Pope sent messages to everywhere, confiscate the Talmud, and the only person to do it was King Louis IX, who ended up becoming Saint Louis. 1236. This is when Nicholas Donin, he went to the church. In 1239, Pope Gregory said to confiscate all the Talmuds, and the Franciscans and the Dominican friars, they were in charge of making sure what was right and what was wrong. And in 1240, they put the trial on trial. They put the Talmud on trial, and in 1242, 24 cartloads of Gemaras, and I'm sure other Sfarim as well. I think about 1,200 manuscripts. 1,200 manuscripts. Every one of those was handwritten. The printing press did not come until the end of the 1400s, around the time of 1492. That's how I remember it. Maybe a few years before. Now the Maram's role in this, he wasn't one of the debaters. He was a student at the time, but he wrote a poetry. He wrote a kinna, which we do say on Tisha B'Av for this. It's called Shali Srufa Ve'esh. We went through it a little bit, how we're without Gemaras, without our Sfarim, everything is like black. And you'll find it, it's the Mem Aleph, Shali Srufi Ve'esh. Okay, and we mentioned also, in this, I think we ended here, that for the next 2 years also, they kept confiscating. So every so often, the non-Jews will come into the Jewish section. If they found any Gemaras or Talmuds around, they would confiscate it until 1247. So then the Pope, I think there was a Pope Innocent, the next Pope, so he came around and he said to the France and everybody else, don't, from here on in, we don't confiscate, we just censure. And now we today have a something called Chesronos HaShas. So the Jews since then have really self-censored our own Gemaras. We don't want to put in anything that has any references to Christianity. We don't want pogroms. We don't want to be killed, exiled, and all the terrible things. So either they took the Gemara, those parts, out totally, or they disguised it. They put it in a way that wouldn't be outright that it was against Christianity. Now, when the printing presses came in, the church realized how powerful this was, the power of the press. I mean, like we all know it today, I mean, like how powerful that press is and what you could do with the media. You know, you just keep saying the same lies over and how powerful that is. So they had a system of a censor, that you could not have anything printed in any of the Christian countries unless you had the seal of the censor. And, how is, you know, Ktais HaChoshen. So you're going to have to sit and learn the entire Ktais HaChoshen with the censor. I mean, he's going to, or any safer, they're going to be able to know what's in it. It's Hebrew. And so they came up with an accommodation. They you know, it's a lot of like looking the other way here or there. And as long as nobody was caught, as long as, you know, there wasn't something really there that the censor missed, then everything was okay. You know, we all know, okay, you're not supposed to write it. And we wrote in the beginning, they would write in the beginning of Sfarim, we don't on purpose know of anything against Christianity, and if there is, it's a mistake, and the censor would, okay. But that already was back here in 1247. Nothing could be against the church. Now the Yamshel Shlomo. I wanted, I guess, to talk about a little bit the Yamshel Shlomo. Yamshel Shlomo was Reb Shlomo Luria, the Marshal. Marshal lived in the, let's see if I have the next one. The Marshal lived in the 1500s, and he would, in his Yamshel Shlomo, at certain points, he was like, not a historian, but he would go back, and he was, what he said about the, about Rabbeinu Asher and his Rebbe, that Reb Meir Rotenberg was the leader of his generation. This is the Yamshel Shlomo, you could buy it today. He brings the Tshuvas HaRashba, and just to show you the esteem, the Rashba was the leader of his generation. The Rashba was a Talmud of Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban. That was the Rashba, and the Rashba writes in his tshuva about Reb Meir, what could I do? Reb Meir is an elder. He's still sitting in the academy, and he's already ruled on the issue. In other words, even though I may disagree with him, but since Reb Meir of Rottenberg paskened on this, I'm not going to touch it. I'm not going to argue on the great Marami Rottenberg. So you see, even like from the Rashba, that's what he was. The Tashbatz was one of his talmidim and wrote like a lot of halachas. Today we do a lot of halachas based on the psakim, based on the Marami Rottenberg. For example, the Marami Rottenberg actually washed hands before kiddush. I think Yekis actually still do that today. Anybody here wash their hands before kiddush? There's a reason for it. I'm not exactly sure why, but
without a bracha, right?
No, with a bracha. This is Friday night. They would wash their hands, maybe Shabbos lunch too, but they would wash their hands, make a bracha, make kiddush, and then make hamotzi.
Well, if you didn't use wine, if you used only a challah.
So maybe that's the reason. I'm not sure the reason. It could be the reason that they were
Europe,
so poor.
In Europe,
that
they couldn't afford wine.
They couldn't afford wine, so they were making it on challah, so that's where they would wash.
Right.
And make on the Tilas Yadayim, make Kiddush on the Challah, so then they would always do it all the time. Could be.
Right.
Could be. But I do know I was eaten by people from German background, and they actually did that. And they warned me. They said, before you wash, they said, make sure don't talk. You know, because then sure enough, like, I washed, I heard Kiddush, drank, and then I said something. They said, you gotta keep quiet till after hamotzi. And after the challah, they said, we warned you, don't. I guess they were used to people that did it, our way, not the. Three matzahs by the Seder. By the Seder, how come you had three matzahs? I guess for the many reasons. One of the reasons that are given here is that the three matzahs, the carbon todah. When you brought a carbon todah, you brought with it four types of breads. Three of them were types of matzahs, and one was a type of challah. So you had three matzahs for the Seder to represent the three different types of matzahs of the carbon todah, to exclude the one of chametz. That's what we also do this today. I guess it could be before the Marami Rottenberg, they may have only had two matzahs at the Seder. But he was the one that set forth the minhag. Maybe there was different minhagim, but we follow that. No tefillin in the morning of Tisha B'Av. We do this. We don't put on tefillin until after Chatzos. Sfardim, they put tefillin on at home before they come to shul. They put it on, say Shema, take it off, and go to shul. But we put it on by mincha of Tisha B'Av. He was the one that said Shachianu both days of Rosh Hashanah. It's a machlokus. Is Rosh Hashanah considered Yom Arichta or not? And he paskened, I think we do paskin this one long day, but we do make a Shachianu on both days, and that goes with the next halacha. Is because of that, we should get a new fruit. That was his institution. Try to find a Shachianu to say on a fruit or a new suit or something that you would say Shachianu the second night. And have in mind, when you're saying it in Kiddush, have in mind that new fruit or the new suit. That came from the Tashbatz, which all got his psakos from the Marami Rottenberg. Hashem Svasai, you said before Shmona Esrei B'Shach Samayrav, also from Marami Rottenberg. Eat the head of a ram the night of Rosh Hashanah. How many of us do that? Oh, okay. Maybe get away with the head of a fish, And in my house, they don't even do that. I go to the candy store and get these juju fish. That's where we're down to. Okay, Zachreinu L'chayim. He points to that. He points out that in from the Aseret Yemei Tshuva, we have four editions in the Shmona Esrei, and one of them is Zachreinu L'chayim Melachavitz B'chayim Kasvenu B'sefer Chayim. And he said he was very machbit to say L'chayim and not L'chayim. As a matter of fact, in my machzer or my sitter, it actually says to say lo chayim, says this out, because la chayim could also mean lo chayim, and because la could sometimes mean no, negative, I guess, when it comes to nedarim, and therefore we make sure to say lo chayim and not la chayim. There's a minute to fast on the yard side of a mother or a father, and to say Kaddish for the mother in the lifetime of the father. I guess there was a minhag that if one parent was alive, not to say Kaddish, but he was the one that said, you do say it in the lifetime. You'll say Kaddish for your mother even in the lifetime of the father, and to fast on the mother and father's yard site. So these are like 10 different halachos that from the Tashbates bringing, and there are more, but it's bringing from the Maran Rottenberg. Okay, now we're finally up to the imprisonment of the Merami Rottenberg. So let's just go through like what the story, what happened, and then just go backwards. Meir Rottenberg, the son of, set out to go across the sea together with his family. It's not clear where he was going. Some say he was just leaving Germany, which I'll figure out why was he leaving Germany. That's A. But he was going somewhere. Was he going to Eretz Yisrael? I don't know. I don't think I've seen anywhere that anybody that said clearly that he was going to Eretz Yisrael. But he left Germany and he went south towards Italy.
Him or his father?
Huh?
The father went with the family that started the journey, or Rav Meir started the journey?
With Meir. Right? And when he came across, he was in Lombardy, does it say over here? Set across the sea together with his family, his daughter, his son-in-law, and he came to a town situated in the mountain regions in Lombardy-ish Gabergi, if I'm saying it right, okay? Where he intended to wait for his fellow travelers who were to join him on the journey. So he had left Germany, and he was officially in Italy, okay? In the Lombardy region, I think that was a region that could have gone back and forth to Germany or Italy. And there it is, Lombardy. So he was somewhere around here. This is Italy, this would be Germany up here. And he was there, and he was waiting for some of his family's travelers. Okay, so, did I skip anything? Okay, now, the Bishop of Basel, okay, was on his way from Rome, and he happened to have been going with a person who was an apostate. He was a Jew that converted to Christianity, and his name was Kinepi. Anyway, he was a Jew that converted to Christianity, and he recognized, and he said to this bishop, he says, you know, that's not just a regular Jew. That happens to be the Merami Rottenberg. That is the Merami Rottenberg. So the bishop went ahead and got the count, Meinhardt of Gortz, I guess, who it took him and locked him up in prison. And this all happened in the year 1288.
What did he do?
I'm not sure. You'll see in some of the things, what did he do wrong? I'm not sure. Well, this is what they did.
Germany.
Either he was trumped up charges or he left illegally. But in any case, they took him, they locked him up in jail. Why did he leave Germany? Was it that he left because they had trumped up charges on him and then he left to escape, not to get imprisoned or killed? Or was he going somewhere and he wasn't supposed to have left? I'm not sure. I don't know. But they took him and they locked him up. Okay, now he's in jail in a place called Wasserburg. That's where this count locked him up. And this is actually from the Hagois Maimonides. Hagois Maimonides in Hilchos Shabbos 6:6, he writes as follows. I recall the incident when I was in the Tower of Wasserburg. It was Erev Shabbos, and we had made a bonfire to warm ourselves up at night. As we were sitting down, the fire was almost out. The servants of the Lord of the Castle unexpectedly came and made the fire bigger. They clearly said that they were doing it in order that we have pleasure. We sat together, and we were delighted that this happened. So I guess the Shiloh, the Hilchos of Shabbos we're talking about is, if a goy goes ahead, could a goy put fire on for you? Could a goy... heat the house. And here, I think the Gaius Mamas wants to say, I think from the Merami Rottenberg, that I'm not sure if this came from him, but we do have a concept of a chola etzeltzina. Everybody's considered a sick person when it comes to being cold. And therefore, we don't allow a goy to do work for us, generally. A goy can't like just be Machal Shabbos and do everything for you. However, if there's a... for a guy to do work, it's not a deraisa, it's a derabbanan. It's a shvus. It's like a... And we don't allow that unless there's extenuating circumstances. So if there's there's a need, there's another need, so then a guy would be allowed to do a malacha for us. If, let's say, there's a need for the community, let's say in a shul, there's a need for the tzibor, so that may allow us to ask a guy to turn, let's say, turn the lights on in a shul. One of the things that there may be a need is when it's very cold, for if there's something wrong with the, let's say, thermostat, or there's something that you need to add fire. So a guy would be allowed to turn on a fire in order for it to be warm in a house or in an area, especially, let's say, if there's little kids, and so that people wouldn't get sick. So if I'm not mistaken, that's what the Hagayis Maimonides is referring to.
I guess that applies in reverse, too.
What do you mean?
If it's too hot outside.
Yeah, it does, because I had that in my house one summer night. Somebody scraped against, by accident, the thermostat and turned off the air conditioner, and the Rav said that, you know, find a guy to turn the air conditioner back on. It was like, you know, well, you could, I don't have to tell anybody, you know what it could be on a hot summer night. Okay, so in any case, the guys of Maimonides, if I'm not mistaken, this is talking about a guy doing work, and he's bringing a Maisa that he was with the Maimon Rottenberg in Wasserburg. Okay, so that's just like almost like confirmation. I guess even though he was in jail, he was allowed to be with his students. Okay, by the, this is a picture, I guess, a black and white picture of the Tower of Wasserburg. I think it's black and white anyway. You can't see how green the grass is. But this is what a Tower of Wasserburg would look like if this is the tower that the Marami Rottenberg was put in. But this is a tower in Wasserburg. Maybe this is it. Okay, another one is at the end of the in the end of the Tashbatz, which we just mentioned. I found the file is written. Rav Meir of Rottenberg was imprisoned in the Tower of Wasserburg, Ashobia he calls it, and it was called Tashbatz because it was based on the questions of Rav Shimshon ben Tzadik. The Tashbatz asked him, okay, fine, and he said that this work was authored Rav Meir when he was imprisoned in the Tower of Wasserburg. So this is when he was there, they were working on this sefer with his student. Then from there, once they agreed to pay the rush, his student agreed to be responsible to collect the money, they moved him from Wasserburg to Einsenschein, which is a different place, I think, to better quarters. It was probably a nicer
tower.
Yeah, nicer tower could be, but it was nicer. Okay, so there's also, this is in Hagayis Maimonides, also brings down when the entire first 3 hours of the day to recite Kriya Shema while in the Tower of Eisenstein. That's, he asked him, so Hagayis Maimonides asked the Rav Meir Rottenberg when he was in the Tower of Eisenstein, that this Shaila. So again, it's brought down where he was at the time. Okay, now the story that we have, a lot of the story is taken from the Yom Shel Shlomo, the Shlomo Shlomo Luria I mentioned before, 1510 to 1573. It was a big posek. He, the Yom Shel Shlomo, and there he refers to different things. And here he brings down in Gittin, he brings down this story, and he brings down something which we're all familiar with, the reason why he died in prison, he wasn't redeemed. Yom Shel Shlomo was going to say a reason. So the Yom Shel Shlomo writes, he heard a report about the Marami Rottenberg. He was imprisoned in the Tower of Einsenschein for many years. The overlord demanded from the communities a large sum, and the communities were willing to redeem him. He did not let them do so. Now this is what the Yom Shel Shlomo, again, notice the Yom Shel Shlomo was 1510 to 1575, so you're talking about 200 years later. So this is being written 200 years after the fact. So the Yom Shel Shlomo was recording, he writes that the Marami Rottenberg said he did not allow them to redeem them. Everybody was saying, oh, we'll redeem you. He said, no, don't redeem me. One is not allowed to redeem captives at more than their normative price. So the Yom Shel Shlomo says, I don't understand this. First of all, Rav Meir was an extraordinary scholar, and there was no one in his generation that compare with his knowledge of Torah. It can't be that Marami Rottenberg was able to keep up his learning in a jail, as he would if he'd be home. So his question is on the Marami Rottenberg, why did the Marami Rottenberg not allow himself to be redeemed? And yes, they did ask for an exorbitant amount, which I'm going to show you, which I think I have the amount about what it's cost, what it would be. But like his question is like, how come the Marami Rottenberg wouldn't allow it. This is in Gittin when it talks, I think it does talk about the redeeming Gittin, redeeming captives there. One is allowed to redeem such a person for all the money in the world. The reason he felt he was unworthy, just because of his great humility, he still, you know, that, so Yamsha Shoma says, even in all, with all his humility, he still would should have allowed himself to be, redeemed. How could I be concerned about the sin of the cessation of Torah study? With all your humility, you know you're a great learned person, and all the bittul Torah that's going on, you should have allowed yourself to be redeemed. That's what he said. So he says it must be. This is what the Yamsel Shomo concluded. It must be that it was the opinion that if they redeemed him, there'd be a real fear that all the nobility would follow suit and imprison the most prestigious Torah authorities. So now, oh, look at this, we can make fast money, we can make big money. So if we're going to take out the, you know, if they're going to see, wow, look what we got from the Maamar Rattenberg, then all Gedolim, nobody's going to be safe. And that's what he writes. And this would be cause an impossible burden on the world jury. So he said, let there be a little bit of Bittul Torah now, so then let there be a little bit a Torah now, rather than this happening in the future. Okay, and this is what the Rav Shlomo Luria, Yom Shel Shlomo, in Perek Dalid, that he writes. That he speaks about the takanos. You know, in the Perek of Gittin speaks about different takanos, about redeeming. We don't redeem tikkun olams. One is we don't redeem for more than the amount. And he brings this maisa down. He says, how come? He says, we don't say that on the Gadol Ador. I mean, but the answer is he says that the Maamar Rattenberg said no. Now, that may not... It's not only me that's saying, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying there's another opinion that's saying that that is not the reason, necessarily the reason, why the Maamar Rattenberg was not freed. Okay, just the Seder Adoros. Again, this is another history sefer. The Seder Adoros writes he died in prison because the king had brought false claims against him. Seder Adoros does not say what these false claims are. Are the false claims that he left the country without permission, without an exit visa? Was it that something else happened, and that's why he was on the run, and he got caught? He doesn't say. But the Seder Adoros says there was some false claims against him. He was asked a tremendous sum of money. The Rav was poor. The king did not want any other Jew except for Rabbeinu Asher, which is the Rush. And the Rush agreed to be the guarantor to try to get the money. They transferred Rav Meir to a much better prison. That's probably from Wasserburg to Einsenheim. And in the middle of all this, he died in prison. Rav Asher ended up fleeing with his son. He sent his son ahead of him, and he ended up fleeing to Spain, to Toledo. And this is the Seder Hadoros, quoting from the Shalshalas HaKabbalah. Also, Rav Yehuda ben Arush. Rav Yehuda was one of his eight sons. He took over as Rav of Toledo after the Rush, and he writes in his last will and testament, the reason my father of the Rush came to Germany was related to the imprisonment of the Mayor of Rattenberg. When they imprisoned Rav Meir, and they were willing to pay a tremendous sum to have him redeemed, the only guarantor was my father. And before the collection of money was divided amongst all the communities, he passed away while still in prison. The ruler falsely libeled my father, saying that since Rav Meir died in prison, he was still under the responsibility of giving the money. So what, he died? I want your money anyway. So as a result of that, so the Rush, first of all, he removed himself from the city where the king was at the time, and then he left. He left Germany. He said he wasn't safe there, so he ended up going to Spain. Okay, that's what Rav Yehuda HaRush in his last will and testament explaining.
They didn't mention any place the concept of maybe they're wanting to take the Rush since, you know, the Maamar Shor died. So now maybe they want to keep the Rush for the rest of the Jewish community.
It didn't seem that they want to put him in prison, but they just wanted the money. I mean, that's really all they wanted.
Why did his body get a proper burial?
Okay, so we're going to see that also. And it wasn't until 1307, but there's reasons for that. Mm-hmm. So now what's going on here? Why was he arrested? We really don't know. But so far you see over here is that they're raising money for him. Now, if the Maamar Rattenberg said, I don't want to be redeemed, why is the Rush, why is everybody raising money? Were they raising money against the wishes of the Maamar Rattenberg? See, Rav Shlomo Luria was saying he wasn't redeemed. It must be he wasn't redeemed because he said, I don't want to be redeemed. And why would he say such a thing? Because he doesn't want this to occur again and again. But you do see from here is that they are trying to raise the money. Now again, this was 1286 he was put in prison. He wasn't transferred until 1288. And the rush, he dies in 1293. That's 5 years. Now, okay. Also, there's a tshuva from the Tshuvas Maharam himself, and he writes, "When I leave prison in peace, I will make the effort to make sure that my commentaries on Zerayim and Taurus will be copied to you. I have not forgotten my Creator in my imprisonment, and in His Torah in all that I have clung. The generous one should see the pleasantness of Hashem. The shine of my most precious gold shall not dim." He's talking about his learning. I'm still learning and everything. And when I get out, I'll copy it. So it sounds like from this tshuva, Tshuvas Maharam from Lemberg 151, this tshuva, he's thinking of getting out. He's planning on getting out. So, you know, what happened? So it could be, in fact, what happened is that he was not buried until the generous spirit of Rav Ziskin Wimpin. City of Frankfurt gave an enormous sum of money, but that was in the philanthropist died shortly afterwards. That was not till 1307. Okay, why do I have this? Okay, so basically, what was happening, or could have, a reason could have been, is that they had to raise the money, and the amount of money that they wanted was a tremendous amount of money, and it wasn't like German Jewry was doing very well. It wasn't like a at this time already, English Jewry wasn't doing well either. But, you know, maybe English Jewry in its heyday could have paid this. But there were a lot of things going on that the German Jewry was having a hard time collecting the money. And that seems to be one of the reasons why it was taking so long. And there were other factors that happened, and that's going to be what was happening in Germany at the time. Happening in Germany at the time is really the king died and there was a civil war. So in reality, there was nobody to talk to. That was also part of the issue. There's a Tosis in Baba Kama on Daf Nun Ches Amud Aleph, and basically the Tosis talks about an unbelievable thing. He says, regarding the Jews who fled their city and whose property was confiscated by the overlord, the people of the city, even though there were no taxes due, or even when there was a tax due, and the property was held in trustee of another Jew, if a Jew comes forth and he's the real owner, it must be returned to him. In other words, the Jew who left, the money, the property was confiscated by the noble or whatever, and he sold it to another Jew, and now the original Jew comes, the original Jew gets it back. The owner, however, is required to pay him. Okay, he has to pay him for expenses or other things, but the fact that the owner takes it from him is not considered the rightful exercise of government law. Dina de Malchus Adina, but rather robbery. Okay? And that's what Tosa says. What I'd like to say also, and maybe this has to do with why the Maharam of Rottenburg had to leave, is the kings at that time was trying to copy the kings of England. So the kings of Germany were trying to copy the kings of England. Kings of England held the Jews as their personal property. You belong to us. You're my property. And therefore, if anybody in England, remember we did this a few weeks ago, anybody in England would start up with any of the Jews, the king would say, they're my property. So you're it's like attacking the king. It's like destroying the king's property. Would you go to the king's palace and burn it down? You wouldn't. So you're taking the Jews, and you're taking the Jews are my property. So this finally was trying to get caught on in Germany. So King Rudolf I was trying to hold that situation too. And that was not so. And, we see throughout the country, the Jews, in reality, this is what Tosis is writing, Jews had a legal right similar to the right of knights to live wherever they wanted to. And they can go wherever they want. This is the custom throughout Burgundy. The overlord comes forth and changed the law. It's not to be viewed as a valid government law. So it could be at this time, they were trying to change the law, and they were trying to say, Jews are the property of the king. And the king, whatever, could do what they want, and the overlords, the nobles, they could do what they want. They belong to the king. The Maharam speaks about this, and the Maharam says, you asked about the king who made the community security and libeled them Basically, they took a whole city. He said, "And this city owes me money, and I'm taking you all as security." And basically, the city collected money for the king, and somebody in that city did not want to pay. So now there is this guy Reuven, whoever, he didn't want to pay. So Shiloh went to the Jewish Marshal, the Maram. Could they force this Jew to pay? Because the whole city was being forced. And he says, first of all, by law, the king has no right to hold one Jew as a security for another. This is only robbery, and the king, robbery of the king, and it's not a valid law which the king has the right to impose. So in other words, whether he's dealing with, before he deals with that issue, he's dealing with the issue is what the king did was not, he has no right to do that. I guess that's Jewish law or else German law. And this is what Rudolph I actually did. He ended up concerning everyone, especially the Jews, and as much as they are servants to our chamber. So that's what Rudolph was changing, since it seemed that all persons of possession pertain to us. So this was made, very interesting, it was made December 6, 1286, when confiscating the property of fugitive Jews. Now this is when, 1286 is when Maharami Rotenberg was caught in Italy. It was in August, a few months before. But it could be this was already going on for some time, and maybe that's why the Maharami Rotenberg had to leave. I don't know, just a theory, just an idea. He was very forceful, being the leader of the Jewish community, the Jewish Jews in Germany, saying, what the king wants is illegal, and we're not gonna give into this. We're not his properties, and therefore that could put him, against the king, and it could be the king was a marked man, and because of that, he felt he was better off leaving. It's a possibility of maybe that's why he left, or it could be that the king already said, if you're my property, you're not allowed to leave. And because of that, because the Maharami Rotenberg left, either for whatever reason, but once you left and you were the property of the king and you didn't want to, and you left without his permission, that could be a reason why he was put in prison. So these are maybe different reasons why he had to put in prison. Okay, again, Jewish Maram, claim made by King Rudolph. Again, we view the Jews as free men who have fallen on hard times and as not those to be sold into slavery. Again, he was, in his Jewish, he said that what the Germans are trying to do, change what the Jews are, we're not going for it. We are free men and we are not the property of the king. Now the economic situation. So it could be, the reason why they didn't redeem him is economically they couldn't raise the money, or they were in the middle. Yeah.
He's writing it down, but there's nobody making it effective for the king. But I still say wrong.
I'm sure there were people that went to the king and said, "Listen, this is not what we believe."
Goyim went to the king.
Goyim, or maybe Jews themselves. I mean, I'm sure. Look, there were representatives to the king. The king knew that the Jews had a vital function in Germany as all countries, and they were the kings needed them for taxes, for money. They were the middle class, and they were the money lenders, which would spark businesses. They did serve a vital role, and they were making money on the Jews, and it was in their best interest to take care of the Jews. And for the most part, the German kings and emperors did do that. I mean, it's a matter of logic, sense, and they always came up with, they were always in very often at odds with the church that wanted to put the Jews down. The church, policies from Rome, and also the local priests and that showed hatred on a local level, and it was always the kings that, with their armies, when they had strong armies, so the Jews were better protected. So now, when Rudolph is trying to change the laws, so the Jews, they were outspoken. I don't exactly know how outspoken they were to the king. Of course, he said the wrong thing, they would kill you. But But okay, the economic situation. So there are many things that would have happened in the leading up for the past 20 years back. You can go even further back, but let's say in the year 1262, in the city of Tabatnia in Germany, there was a libel against the Jew killed one of the female heirs of, I guess, the government. The king investigated, it was false. Afterwards, they made a false accusation that this is the host, that the transubstantiation, whatever, that they were desecrated the host, the wafers and all that thing, and then the Jews did that, and the burghers came out and killed the majority of the Jews. The rest converted. I don't think they came back. Seder Doros also. 1264, Bishop of Magdeburg persecuted Jews of Saxony, fined them a sum of 100,000 marks of pure silver. This is silver, not gold. 1272, devastating famine. All parts of Germany. Many people died of starvation. So this is 72. This is 16 years before, you know, I don't know how quickly the economics recover. Blood libel. 1283 to 1285. Now we're getting closer. These are the 2-3 years preceding the imprisonment of the Marmor Rottenberg. 10 Jews murdered in Mainz, 26 Bacharach, 40 in Orwellian, 180 in Munich. Again, I don't know if it was major, but still, the things were happening. Okay, the claim made by King Rudolf I. The Jews promised King Rudolf 20,000 marks in order that he would mete out justice and give him the Jews and free their rabbi and leading teacher. This was some chronicles in 1288. That's what's written. Okay, 20,000 marks. So I was just, what is a mark? A mark was 8 ounces of gold. So if they wanted 20,000 marks, is 160,000 ounces of gold. So I just went on one of the sites. How much in today's value, okay, if you wanted 160,000 ounces of gold, what would it cost you today? So on December 15th, the bid price, the asking price, the day's range, so it was either $1,129.50, or the asking price is, I don't know what all this was. But I took 160,000 ounces of gold and times it by $1,130. So in today's day and age, the amount of money that they would have asking in order to free the Marmor Rottenberg would be about $177,800,000. So again, if I'm right, if I'm pretty sure, the old mark, there was an old mark that which was 8 ounces of gold. So if that was the same mark, we saw before marks of silver, 100,000 marks of silver, but that, you know, there's also a tremendous amount, but nothing like this. This is marks of gold. I know gold just like doubled in the past few years. But this is even if it didn't, even if take off the double, it's still, what is it? Still 80, 90 million dollars worth of gold. So this is what they were asking the community of Germany, to raise. Okay. Then what had happened in addition? Okay. This is this is Rabbi Yechiel ben. This is Rabbi Chaim ben Rabbi Yechiel. Now this could be, this Rabbi Yechiel is very possible, it could have been the brother of the Rosh or the oldest son of the Rosh. Could be he was the oldest son of the Rosh. The 12 communities promised to pay 23,000 pounds to the king. Then the Sanhedrin should fail to carry out his promise. We do not owe anything. And we said, we will not pay anything if you don't keep your word. I guess you could see you were asking, how did they talk to the king? He was very forceful with his promise. He says, we are not going to owe you anything if you don't keep your word. So the king said three times we're under an obligation to pay you. If you fulfill your solemn promise to us, you shall be paid. The king's answer was, if I keep my part of the bargain, all will be well. Otherwise, you shall not pay me anything. So again, this is Marami Rattenberg. He brings this. He didn't have too much in his possession. This is many years in jail. He says, how can I learn? I don't have any sperm with me, and I'm not just the same. It's very hard for me to learn. And this is written from his cell in Eisenstein to the rush. Okay, Rudolf the First. Now, this is also complicated matters. Okay? In 1286, the Maran Miratin was thrown in jail. 1288, he makes it to Eisenstein. He's brought back and now imprisoned by King Rudolf. King Rudolf made the mistake, but he died in 1291. 1291, he died. The Maran was still in jail. Now, what happens now? Who's the next emperor? Well, what happened is now you need to have elections. So who are you going to pay the... Who is now authorized to free the Maran? Okay, let's say they had the money at that point. Who are you going to give it to? You know, so basically what happened is the role of emperor, the role of king, was they never wanted it to be in Germany. They never wanted it to be a hereditary king, like in France, like in England. So the way they decided who the emperor was is he had if I'm not mistaken, something along the lines, he had like these seven electorates, seven of the major parts of Germany, and they would all decide who was going to be the emperor. After he died, then they would vote on somebody else. Now, King Rudolf really, really wanted his son, Albert. Oh, by the way, he was a Habsburg. I think he was the first of the Habsburgs. And the Habsburgs were, I think, they were kings up until even the beginning, even in the 19th century. I think this Habsburg line was a line for many, many years. So he wanted his son Albert to be king. But, of course, the Germans did not want it to become a hereditary position. So they voted to give it to a person called Adolf of Nassau. So Adolf of Nassau became the king. Now, Adolf of Nassau was not the best choice for a king. They just, I guess, picked him because Rudolf was pushing that his son become king, and just, I guess, they picked somebody that was not a king. And he did things that angered a lot of the electorates. Germany at the time was many, many city-states, like hundreds of these like little city-states, and, you know, a few bigger ones. And you wanted to keep everybody, you know, together. So from 1292 to 1298, so Adolf was the king. And finally, enough people had enough of Adolf, and Albrecht, the son, was biding his time, you know, making his alliances. And finally, in 1298, they had a war, they had it out. And in the battle, Adolf died, and Albert this time secured enough votes to become the king. So Albert then became the next king of Germany, or emperor of Germany. So first Rudolf, Adolf for about 6 years, and then Albert. And Albert is going to be from 1298 to 1308. From 1292 to 1298, chaos. It was terrible. When there was no strong central government with an army, then the Jews were, that's it, easy targets. Because who's going to come after? Where's the imperial army? Who's going to come after us? Now, okay, I spoke this out. Albert won. In 1298, he was chosen German king by some of the princes. And he had a battle with Adolf where he killed Adolf. Now he became the king. However, this is 1298. It says things about Albert. He did have a keen sense of justice. He did listen to serfs, and he even protected the Jews somewhat. Not in the very beginning. I just want to... Just now, this is something that happened starting in 1296. Again, 1296, it started under Adolf, the weak king, the king that was, he was just, get everybody, wasn't, nobody was happy with him, and he was very selfish, and he was doing things that were going against the interests of Germany at large. And he was this person Rindfleisch is going to. He was a knight, and he was very bad. He, in his mind, he was commissioned by God to kill the Jews, to right all the wrongs. And at the time, he was able to do this because there was, I guess, sort of a civil war going on between Albert and Adolf, and there wasn't no strong central government. And basically, he was, for 1298, he started a pogrom, and he went from place to place. He accused the Jews of, again, profaning the host, incited the burghers to kill them. This is the first place 21 Jews were murdered. But he didn't stop there. This is the Rhineland. This is a lot of the area. This is the Rhine River, the Rhineland. This is a lot where the Jews were in Germany, where they were killed. And basically, I just want to get to this. Okay. I just, the mob went from, he got a mob, and he went from town to town to town, and the end is, when all is said and done, first of all, Mordechai ben Hillel, this is the Mordechai, the Talmud of the Rami Rottenberg, the one who wrote the Mordechai in the back of the Gemara, he was killed in one of these pogroms. But this is really what I want to get to. We're going to end over here. That's spreading from the Franconia and Bavaria to Austria. The persecutors destroyed 146 communities. About 100,000 Jews were killed in these 2 years. So now, while this is happening, again, the Marami Rottenberg had died in 1293, okay, under Adolf. Things were very, very weak there, things for the Jews. They're still trying to get all this money. 1296, starting 1296, but mainly in 1298, you have most of Germany, German Jewry is wiped out. He just went from town to town to town, and there was nobody and nothing to stop him. This was the biggest destruction since the Crusade, since the First Crusade of German Jewry. And now, so you begin to wonder, it's like, you know, meanwhile the Maram's body is languishing in prison, and there's no way to collect the money. Who are you going to get the money from? Where? What? You know, there's nothing, you know, it's not possible. When Albert became king, so eventually what happened is Albert became king again, and he restored order. At first he was afraid to, because again he just had won the battle against Adolf, and Albert the first few years had to solidify his power. So he was afraid right away to go after Rindfleisch. But finally, when he got himself strong and he got himself settled, then it was better for what was left of the Jews then. Okay, and he was, and finally in 1307, there was a person by the name of Wimfeld, okay, that did it. But there's a legend that goes along with this person. In 1307, so finally there was a rich Jew from Frankfurt, and he went ahead and he was able to, he gave a lot of money to the king, to King Albert, for the burial of Remeyer Rottenberg. And he was requested it, and with that money they buried him. All his request was is that he be buried next to the Marami Rottenberg, which he was. But that night he had a dream after the burial, and Remeyer came to him and said, you have one of two choices. Either you or all your posterity for all time will merit a long life with wealth and honor, or you immediately die and merit the world to come. So he chose to immediately die, and that's exactly what happened. Immediately upon arising, he took ill, made his list when the testament and his family died. This Shlomo Wimpel came to a dream to the rabbi of the city and told him the promise was fulfilled, and he was placed with Rav Meir. The wealthy man who bought the rabbi of burial was Alexander ben Shlomo. This is all brought in the Seder Adoros. And I guess we're going to pick it up next week. I was going to pick it up with the Rush, because now the Rush had collected quite a bit of money. And what's going to happen with the Rush and the King Albert, who's going to die in 1308, and the king that comes after.